Extension 720 with Milt Rosenberg on 720 WGN.
Stephen Brill, as I told you a few moments ago, is our guest tonight, a very eminent fellow. At a mere young age of 60 or 61, he's made an incredible career for himself. He founded Journalism Online, a company designed to create a new and viable business model for journalism. He is a feature writer for The New Yorker, The New York Times Magazine, and Time Magazine. He founded the Yale Journalism Initiative, which recruits and trains journalists, and he founded and ran Court TV. You remember that? It's still there, I gather, and
yes.
Very effective. Founded the American Lawyer Magazine, and for a while, Brill's Content, a magazine which we talked about when it was just getting off,
yes, I remember,
off the table, so to speak. And now he is the author of a book titled Class Warfare, subtitle, Inside the Fight to Fix America's Schools. This all started with a piece you did for The New Yorker about, what do they call those rooms?
They're called the rubber rooms.
The rubber rooms, which is what you also have. That's what they call isolation rooms in psychiatric hospitals.
Yeah, these were a little different. This is a story that I sort of stumbled on as I had sold various businesses I had started and wanted to go back to magazine writing. And had heard about – I'd always been interested in public education and why it didn't work, and it seemed like it wasn't working, and had this sense that the unions had sort of gotten too much of a good thing, too much control as opposed to protection from abuse. They now – the inmates were running the asylum.
Mm-hmm.
And I'd heard about these places called the rubber rooms where – turns out the minority of the minority of the minority of teachers in New York City, just 600 or 700 of them, who were deemed to be so abusive, so incompetent, so intolerable to have in a classroom, that a new reform administration, Mayor Bloomberg's administration, decided they had to get them out of the classroom. Problem is, you can't fire them because the tenure laws that the unions had lobbied to pass in state capitals.
It's worse in the city of Chicago. Some years ago when I looked into it, in the city of Chicago, teachers who were generally considered to be absolute blowouts and really almost a danger in school would be kept on retained on one or another basis.
They don't
basis.
Have rubber. I mean, at least the
they
virtue of the
rubber rooms. But they could only fire two or three a year over all the years.
No, the others would just have
watching.
To report to, desks somewhere by themselves where they would do nothing, or they were told to stay home. In New York,
but in New York, they found some 700 who they thought might be appropriate for dismissal. We never found that many in Chicago.
They found a bunch in Chicago, but they didn't put them in one room where some pesky reporter, me, could go find them. And so I got introduced to the issue of education reform when I showed up one day at one of these rubber rooms in a—
How many of them were there?
There were five of them scattered
around the boroughs.
Scattered around the boroughs.
Yeah.
There were two in Brooklyn, none in Staten Island. And I walked into this place, and there's a guy about my age, unshaven, dressed in a T-shirt and jeans, sitting at a desk, his head down, fast asleep— an alarm clock next to his ear, and the alarm clock was set for 3:15 in the afternoon because in the rubber rooms, you serve your time exactly the way you would in a classroom. So the hours of the day are the same as the classroom. So at 3:15, you had to wake up and leave, which he had this alarm clock to do. There was another woman near him who had brought a beach chair there.
They were waiting while they were somehow being reviewed and investigated for a final determination as to whether they would be.
Well, it wasn't much of an investigation. There was arbitration hearings they would have.
Uh-huh.
And these arbitration hearings, again, under laws lobbied in Albany, or the state capital of New York, by the union, the arbitration hearings couldn't happen more than 2 days in any month. And only one day a month during the summers, because you don't want to work people too hard in these arbitration hearings. As a result, these hearings would last 2 to 3 to 4 to 5 years, all the while the teacher's getting his or her salary, accruing lavish pension benefits, full health care for everybody in the family. And at the end, they were never dismissed anyway because the arbitrators, who had these $1,400-a-day jobs— had to be approved every year by the teachers union. So they were reluctant to rule. So they would compromise and say, oh, well, you get a 10-day suspension or nothing. But nothing ever happened. So when I was doing this story, just as I was doing this story, and this is a good sort of lesson in journalism, the local NPR affiliate in New York did a story about these same teachers in the rubber
room. WNYC?
Exactly. Yeah. And what they said, they quoted these people, I guess when they could wake them up, and they said they were whistleblowers, they were persecuted because they had defied Mayor Bloomberg's efforts to reform the system, and the system was corrupt, and they were being singled out because they were senior teachers with higher salaries. So they quoted them, and then they quoted the, you know, the city administration, and it was the classic sort of fair on the one hand, on the other hand story. Well, I decided that there had to be a way to know if this was true, because you had, again, these arbitration hearings where some poor soul had to type up everything, had to keep a transcript. So there were thousands of pages of transcripts for each hearing, and I dove into these transcripts and found, for example, one teacher whom I met. Her lawyer, paid for by the union, her lawyer's defense of the fact that she had never done lesson plans, assigned homework, graded papers, put anything on the bulletin board, put anything on the blackboard, that she'd never done any of that, was he contested whether she had ever had custody of her teacher's manual. He didn't contest the facts. He contested because you couldn't contest the facts. She hadn't done this stuff and everybody knew it. His point being, well, if she didn't have custody of her teacher's manual, how is she supposed to know that she's supposed to hand out homework, grade papers, put stuff up on the bulletin board, issue report cards? How's, you know, how's a teacher supposed to know she's supposed to do all that stuff unless there's a teacher's manual? Now, obviously, she'd had the teacher's manual, but it was sort of the classic kind of, you know, criminal defense on a technicality. Yeah.
But the deal process the union has with the city enables them to absolutely protect these people, ultimately to route them back to the classroom and to preserve their income and even augment the income.
Right. Now, again, this is a minority of teachers, to be fair. But
well, only they're the worst of the worst.
Well, but what I came to believe, and I'll give you one other example.
Sure.
One of the teachers, the union at that time, before I did the article, had a page on its website devoted to the rubber room, believe it or not, their point being that these were human rights violations.
Uh-huh.
And they had one teacher featured there who they said had been singled out. She was a history teacher at Stuyvesant High School, which is one of the high schools in New York where you have to take a test to get in. It's a superstar mm-hmm. kind of high school. She'd been singled out because she had seniority and she was making a high salary and she was a whistleblower. Well, the facts, again, in the arbitration transcripts were that she'd been discovered by her class dead drunk, passed out, asleep at her desk. Her bottle of water next to her was in fact a bottle of vodka. And the worst part of it was when I found her to get her comment, she didn't know that she had been depicted that way on the union's website as a victim of, you know, persecution. And she was angry about it. She said, what are they talking about? I was a dead drunk. I didn't belong in a classroom. I'm an alcoholic. I'm now rehabilitated. But they shouldn't have said that about me. I wasn't some whistleblower. I was a drunk.
The matter at issue, of course, in this book is not merely whether some teachers are overindulged and get away with essentially poor or no performance while their income and their medical coverage are maintained. The matter of most import is what's the quality of the education that our kids are getting, not merely in New York City, but around the country. And if they're not getting sufficiently good education, one of the immediate variables that needs to be examined is teacher performance and teacher competence. And you are quite convinced from your investigations that there's a great deal that is lacking with regard to teacher performance and teacher competence. Though there are some wonderful teachers and many quite adequate teachers, there are lots who are overprotected by unions who keep them in the system and thus disadvantage the kids who are subjected to those teachers. That's the thesis around which this whole book is woven. And I want to get right down to some of your further investigations. You've talked to all sorts of interesting people.
I went all over the place doing this.
And
what I found is the answer isn't simply that, you know, all teachers are bad.
Of course not.
And that you don't need unions, because I think you do need unions, even teachers' unions. The answer really is that this is the one workplace in America, 3.2 million teachers, the largest occupation in the country other than retail sales clerks and cashiers. And it's the only workplace in America where performance doesn't count. So the really good, dedicated teachers aren't recognized. They're not paid more. They're not honored more. They're not made mentors. And the really, really bad ones aren't recognized either. And the ones in the middle aren't retrained, and they're not focused on, so you can improve their performances where they're weak and help them get better and encourage them to get better and incent them to get better.
And you've now discovered, and indeed a great deal of your book is devoted to, various groups of people, many of them very well healed, with lots of money, not merely millions, but billions at their command, who are concerned about improving the quality of American education, pre-collegiate education, though I would hope that they might also be interested in improving collegiate education, which I think fails in many ways. That's a preoccupation of mine as a veteran higher education academic. But that's what we find in your book. We need to talk about those programs. But a prior question, I raised this just as we stopped for some commercials, is what data do we have, what numbers do we have about the level of education which prevails in this country with regard to what kids come out of high school with, if they get out of high school? And for that matter, a related question is how many never get out of high school, but rather disappear from the roles of students in at least the big city systems long before they might even get a high school degree. How bad is education in this country these days as compared, properly as one would do, to other countries of comparable wealth and civilization, so to speak? Directly back to Stephen Brill as we go in that direction after we pause for these words.
Extension 720 with Milt Rosenberg on 720 WGN.
We will be very interested tonight when we get to the phone-in portion of the program to hear what parents, teachers, students, for that matter, listening to us tonight have to say in response to this analysis, this diagnosis of the problem in America's schools. But what do we have by way of statistics, by way of numbers concerning achievement levels, so that we can compare how well we do or how poorly we do in contrast to, say, Canada, Australia, the Western European countries?
Well, you said at the break, and I smiled when you said it, that you wondered whether we were doing as well as other wealthy nations.
Yeah.
We're not doing as well as nations that have nowhere near our wealth. We spend two or three times as much per student as pretty much every other nation in the world, but we rank 17th, 15th, 20th, depending on the subject and the grade, among the nations of the world. And one would think that you would normally say, well, gee, you know, the Chinese may be beating us, and maybe, you know, South Korea, you know, Singapore, you know, the Asians that we sort of, you know, we stereotype as being, you know, as out achieving us. What about Estonia or Latvia or, you know,
the Baltic
Canada?
Countries. All right, what about them?
Or you just name a country and
I'll take,
you know,
Estonia.
Norway. We fall, you know, below most of the countries you would think of in at least one subject and probably most. And again, it's not about money, but what I try to do in this book is get beyond, you know, policy and beyond numbers to really explain it. And I think the reason that the book has done so well and is, you know, crawling down the bestseller list is that I try to do real reporting and take civilians to this battle that's been raging in this country for the last two or three years. Has been a very quiet revolution that's been instigated not only by sort of traditional Republicans who have looked hard at our education system and said we need to inject, you know, choice into it, we need to inject decent management principles into it, accountability, but also by some Democrats that you might wince at when I mention their names, like Rahm Emanuel. who really was a prime mover in pushing President Obama's very successful Race to the Top program, successful in the sense that it helped to – it was sort of the starting gun for this revolution that is now sweeping across the country, where parents are demanding accountability. Now, what's making parents do that? The charter schools, and that's really what I want to focus on here, because when you ask about comparative achievement, I can say that our schools are failing us. You know, maybe 70% of our kids are graduating even from high school, and those who get a high school diploma, a lot of them aren't prepared for anything.
Let's note, with a local focus for a moment, that the high schools of Chicago graduate considerably less than 70%.
Right, and as do a lot of urban systems. But the comparisons, you don't have to go overseas for a comparison. Part of this book, a chunk of this book, takes place in a building on 118th Street and Lenox Avenue in Harlem in New York. Mm-hmm. And on one side of the building, there's a traditional public school. On the other side of the building, there is what's called a charter school.
Yeah.
Now, as you know, charter schools are public schools. They just operate outside.
But unions don't have the same power within the charter school.
And the unions don't have the power there. On the public school side of the building, they spend more per student than the charter school side. The charter school kids perform on a whole variety of tests the way kids do in Scarsdale, which is a very wealthy suburb of New York. And they perform as well as kids in Singapore and Korea and China. These are kids in Harlem. The same kids as on the other side of the building. On the other side of the building, they perform exactly the way the stereotype, unfortunately.
What has made the difference?
What makes, and this is the essence of what makes the difference, a lot of very intense teaching. Teachers, you know, first of all, the school year starts in August. The school day, something which people in Chicago will be shocked to hear, starts at 7:30 in the morning and ends at 5 o'clock. The teachers get paid a little more, but they don't have, 13 sick or personal days out of a 32-week school year, which amounts to one day off every two and a half weeks. They typically take one sick day off in a year. And there are a lot of other things going on, but I sat in on the two sides of that building, and I watched teachers worry about the little stuff. Were they making eye contact? Had they stayed up the night before really planning a lesson plan? Were they getting feedback from their assistant principals and principals all the time? A principal who wants to give feedback to a teacher on the public school side would often have to have a union representative in the room with him.
Basic question. Between these two schools, the public school and the charter school, both in the same building up in Harlem, were these really matched samples, so
yes,
to speak?
Yes, they were.
Particularly, were the kids in each of the schools equally disadvantaged?
It's the same. Often you'd have siblings on different sides of the building.
Uh-huh.
You have the same parents, the same community. Now,
or
the
maybe
deniers,
the same parent, single parent.
Maybe.
Which is a common.
Now, the deniers of this stuff will throw out all these statistics often that, mm-hmm. well, the charter school, cherry picks the kids. It's nonsense. These are public schools. Every kid can go. The problem with the charter schools is they have so many applicants, they have to have a lottery, and they pick the kids out of a lottery, not based on how smart they are or how much they like the parents or anything like that. The charter school, one day I was there, and I was watching a teacher in a charter school. Actually, maybe we should take the break because it's a long
story. We do have
a
break coming. How sensitive of you to be aware of that. And we will pause for that, and then we'll go back to that charter school.
I want to go back.
And more broadly, I think we need to talk about the whole charter school movement,
mm-hmm.
how it got started, who's moving it, where the big money comes from, where the big interest comes from, and the crucial question upon which you place considerable emphasis of not merely trusting your impressions, but getting hard data in the evaluation of student performance,
mm-hmm.
the ultimate way to test whether charter schools and other new approaches in education are doing better than our standard school systems is whether we see students learning more, retaining it more, and flourishing more in consequence
exactly.
of that learning. We'll turn to all of that with Stephen Brill directly after the update on the evening's news. For that, to the WGN Newsroom and Paula Cooper.
Milt Rosenberg and Extension 720 on 720 WGN.
And we return to Stephen Brill. We're drawing from his very important and utterly readable new book, Class Warfare, Inside the Fight to Fix America's Schools. That's just published by Simon & Schuster. Your method was to run around the country talking to everybody. And we've got wonderful interviews, wonderful conversations, beautifully recounted with your great and considerable journalistic skill.
Thank you.
But let's come directly to it. You found the people who really are very bothered by the low quality of American education and have started a great movement to transform it. Who are they? What are they doing?
Well, let me give you just a glimpse of what motivates them first.
Sure.
I started to say before the break, so I'm in this building where there's a charter school and a public school, and I'm in a classroom with a fifth grade reading English teacher, mm-hmm. this really wonderful, intense teacher. And she has come into the class the night before and posted all along the walls what the school calls juicy words. And they're words that are meant to get the kids to reach higher, to do better. Like, so instead of fat, it's corpulent. Instead of boring, it's tedious. Mm-hmm. And it's part of the ethic of this school, which is we actually expect you to succeed. We're not throwing in the towel because you're poor and you're a minority. We think you can succeed, and we're going to make you succeed. So she's doing a lesson with them on how to do essays. And she suggests a way that they can structure an opening sentence and then figure out how to outline the rest of the essay. And as I'm taking notes, I realize that's really a good trick. And I say to myself, I should remember that. I teach, as I'm explaining to you before we went on the air, a journalism class at Yale College. And I said to myself, that's a really good thing I should do with my students. And here I am in a fifth grade English class in Harlem. And I'm marveling at that, how intense she is and how her high expectations that are being met. 10 minutes later, I walk out of that classroom. I go not 20 feet to the other side of a fire door.
Yeah, to the other school.
Into the public school. The first class I encounter, there is a teacher in, you know, jeans and a sweatshirt, leaning back in a chair almost to the point of falling over, his feet on his desk. The kids are all talking to each other or on the floor wrestling, and he's screaming to them, how many days in a week? How many days in a week? Nobody answers him. Screams again, then again. And then he says, all right, let's move on to something else. Now, the only emotion you can have when you see that, having just been on the other side of the building, is you want to pick those kids up, and you want to carry them to the other side of the building, almost as if, you know, you're in East Berlin and you want to go back through the wall to West Berlin. And to me, that is what this education reform issue is all about. It's about intense teaching. It's about accountability. This woman who was teaching the class actually was an assistant principal, but the English teacher who had been doing it for the first month just wasn't cutting it, and they had asked her to leave. You could never do that in the public school. God knows you'd never have an assistant principal go teach a class.
I was pushing you toward, though I'm very glad you paused to draw that contrast.
So let me come back to
it. But I was pushing you toward the question of who has become aroused over this and what are they doing about it?
Well, the issue of funding, first, what needs to be said is, again, that charter school spends less money per student than the public school. Mm-hmm. However, to get charter schools started, to invest in them, to start them up, you need startup money. And there's a whole group of people, a lot of them from the venture capital community, the private equity community, which is true here in Chicago as well as New York, who see this as a great charitable investment. Because instead of simply pouring out money into a handout, you're investing in something which will become, is, you know, self-sustaining. Once you have enough grades, the school pays for itself because tax dollars go for each kid almost to the amount they go on the public school side. Not quite, because again, the teachers union has legislated it so that you actually get less money for the charter school than the public school. So they provide the seed money, and these are very, you know, leverage oriented, numbers oriented people who have a lot of money, mm-hmm. and are, you know, and are using it in a way that they really believe in. The leaders, the richest of them, include Bill Gates, Eli Broad, who he and his wife have a foundation called the Broad Foundation, which has pumped tons of money into things like this. And the Gates Foundation has used their money not only to support charter schools, but really interestingly, to offer money to public school systems that are willing to take the money in return for experimenting with the kinds of accountability reforms that the research, which Gates Foundation has also funded, makes sense. How can you know? You need to incent teachers. You need to promote them. You need to retrain them. For example, the Gates Foundation has done something which the teachers unions initially were against, which is they not only do peer observations and evaluate how teachers are doing in class, but they do videotapes of them. And then they show the videotapes to the teachers. Originally, even this was opposed by the unions, still is in some places. But I talked to a young teacher who'd been on his high school baseball team, and he said he leaped at the chance to have his class videotaped and to watch the videotape just the way he leaped at the chance when he was in high school to watch a videotape of him swinging his baseball bat because he could see what his swing was like. And so if you're really professional and you really want to improve your game, that's what you do.
You start this book with a scene in the Oval Office at the White House.
Correct.
Let's go to the Oval Office and tell me what was happening on that day.
Well, the when President Obama ran, this was little noticed among all the other issues in the campaign, on a platform of this kind of education reform, the notion of introducing accountability into our public schools. Principals would be accountable. Teachers would be accountable for their performance.
Very important parenthesis. Define accountability. In this context, what does it mean?
Accountability means that you promote people, recruit people, train people, pay people based on how well they perform. In the public school systems of this country, it is largely true that no one measures the performance of teachers because they say you can never measure it fairly.
Is it fair to say that the ultimate index of the performance of teachers is the achievements of the students?
Achievements broadly defined, but don't say testing because that's, then it's not fair to say. No, the reformers want performance to be measured. They do not think, the smart ones, that it's all about how one kid does on one test. You can compare progress from September to June and see how much a kid progresses. But even then, you would temper that with lots of in-class observations of the teacher, lots of comparisons year by year. But the fact is that performance can be measured. If you ask, I did when I was doing my reporting, any fourth grade teacher in any school in this country, you take that fourth grade teacher and you say to that teacher, who's the best third grade teacher and who's the worst third grade teacher? Fourth grade teachers know that. Why do they know that? Because they get the results.
So what happened that day in the Oval Office?
Well, the Obama administration had run, as I said, on a platform that we need to introduce accountability into public education. And they used the stimulus program, $800 billion, they tucked into that program $4 billion in potential education aid grants to states, but with a little bit of a kicker to it, which is you didn't get not everyone was going to get the money. States would compete to get the money, and the states with the 10 or 12 best education reform proposals and the best apparent ability to deliver on them would get the money. And that became what was called the Race to the Top contest. And because it was a contest, it got all this hoopla and attention and drew in 38 or 39 governors who entered the contest. And that ignited a debate about all these education reform ideas all across the country and unleashed this sort of growing network of reformers, both from the financial community, alumni of this program called Teach for America, who'd been in school. So it ignited this whole network of reformers, charter school parents, to get behind each state's application for Race to the Top.
Then two immediate questions that follow on from that are, one, what has been achieved over the last 3 years since this was fired off? But two, we need to really go back to the question of the role of the unions and the degree to which union petrification and union power has somehow impeded the educational process, and where it has not. And we'll continue in pursuit of those and related questions with Stephen Brill directly after this.
Extension 720 with Milt Rosenberg on 720 WGN.
And directly back to Stephen Brill. We are drawing from, but cannot possibly fully duplicate or even partially duplicate, the richness of his new book, Class Warfare, Inside the Fight to Fix America's Schools. But we're developing the overall story or the overall analysis rather than plunging into all of these rich character representations that you've got in the book.
We'd be here for quite a while.
But there are some fascinating people in
this
book. But let's get back to the basic question of what's happened over these last 3 years with regard to charter and yet other innovations.
Well, all these states, as I said, formulated these plans. And then...
But the best laid plans of states are off, gang off to Gray.
Well, exactly. And one of the issues, so here you have the largest competitive grant program in the history of the country, where so and it sort of proves that, you know, democracy is, you know, the least bad form of government, but it's pretty bad, or it's terrible except for all the others. Well, what they have to do to decide who wins these grants, because the government is this terrible bureaucracy, is they have to, the people who are going to vet the applications and decide on who wins have to be disinterested. And the Department of Education bureaucracy, the lawyers there, decide that disinterested is basically defined as they can't know anything about any of this stuff. So you're disqualified if you work in any of these school systems. You're disqualified if you've ever taken a position on education reform. So you end up with people who I interviewed, even though the Department of Education made them sign confidentiality agreements. I mean, you know, just think about that for a minute. The government hires you. They pay these people to give out $4 billion, and then they make you promise not to talk to the press about why you did what you did, which got me going. So obviously I was able to interview a bunch
of them.
I can't
resist asking you, since our local boy is running the Department of Education, is this essentially what the secretary wanted?
That was Arne Duncan's decision.
Arne Duncan.
And it's one issue where I had great disagreement with him about it.
I told you earlier off the air that Arne Duncan's father, Starkey Duncan, was my colleague and a dean at the University of Chicago in the psychology department. And indeed, we published a few articles together.
Well, it's a totally absurd position. You can't have people, you know, come in and decide how the government's money is going to be spent and then say they're not allowed to talk to the press about why they did what they did. But anyway, they were blissfully ignorant of the real issues. So to give you an example, the two states that deserve to win the most by everybody's calculation, including Arne Duncan's, were Colorado and Louisiana, and they didn't get the money. New York, which has no chance of ever keeping the promises it made in its application, got the money. Hawaii, which is a joke, got the money. But some other deserving states got the money. But the interesting thing about this is that just the whole debate and the whole stirring of all this interest was such that states that didn't get the money proceeded with reform plans beyond what anyone would have imagined a year or two ago, including the state of Illinois.
What are the basic reforms they proceeded with? Charter schools, certainly, but what else?
Well, encouraging or at least not blocking charter schools, putting in place real ways of measuring teacher performance. Uh-huh. So that you would incent teachers, promote teachers, have you know, a career path other than how long have you been breathing for teachers. Getting rid of something called LIFO, last in, first out, so that if there are ever layoffs, the way you do it now is on a quality blind test, which is, again, how long you've been breathing. You get to keep your job. If you're a new, young, highly effective teacher, you get fired. So in Illinois, to give you an example, a reform package passed that now allows for the gauging of teachers' performance in the classroom and a more streamlined way of removing teachers who are not performing. It allows for the elimination of LIFO, last in, first out, and it allows for what has to be sort of the abiding embarrassment of the city of Chicago, which is a school day that is a joke. I mean, when I first heard about this, and there's a lot about Chicago in the book and a lot of quotes from the mayor about this, but when I first heard that Chicago's school day was 30 or 40 minutes shorter than New York's, which is laughably short, the New York school day in the contract is negotiated down to the last 30 seconds. It's something like, it's down to the half minute. Chicago's much worse. That's being changed because of these reforms, because of Race to the Top, which they didn't get the money for.
Would you agree that something else that has been set loose by this movement, which has been going for the last 3 years or so, actually there were stirrings before.
Oh, there was a lot before.
The Obama administration came in.
Bubbled up.
Yeah. But yet another thing that is in the picture is attempts directly to limit and to rewrite and reduce the power of the unions, particularly at local, that is at state levels. The best case in point immediately available is what was happening up in Wisconsin.
Yeah, now, I don't think that's in the long-term best interests of schools and school reform. I think that the way to deal with no one is going to call me soft on the teachers' unions, but the way to deal with the abuses in the union contract is to have politicians with the backbone to negotiate better contracts, and legislators to, erase laws. A lot of the stuff in union contracts is mandated by state law because the unions are have heretofore been even more powerful in state capitals than they have been at the bargaining table. So a lot of that, for example, in Illinois, the school year in Chicago couldn't be changed because of a state law. So I don't think that getting rid of the unions is healthy and in the best interest of the kids, because ultimately, as I say toward the end of the book, you can't do this with charter schools. You can't do this with 5 or 10 or 100,000 truly heroic teachers when you're dealing with 3.2 million teachers. You have to bend the system, make the system work better, change the contract, change the school day, change the training, and you have to get the unions to help you do that.
Now, the best experiment in the real world that we can check on is to look at all of the charter schools which have come up in recent years and to examine how well their kids perform as compared to non-charter schools, schools within the standard systems. Do we have a great national study which has attempted to do that?
There are multiple national studies, and the school reform deniers pick out the ones that say a low percentage of charter schools really work, and the adamant reformers pick out the ones that say a larger percentage work. To me, that's irrelevant. The charter schools, in that sense, whether 30% are really good or 70% are really good, is irrelevant. It's only relevant that one of them is effective, because if one of these schools is effective, spending less money than the public schools, what that proves, and it's obviously more than one, but what that proves is that the expectation of failure can be broken. What that proves is that if you have really effective teachers in front of the class and really effective school leaders, that you can overcome, not always, but you have a real shot at overcoming poverty and broken homes and all the other baggage that these kids come with. So charter schools, it's not relevant what percentage of them work. They'll all work if managed well and run well. The problem is in states, for example, like Ohio, the granting of charters is really lackadaisical and subject to political favors, or they're trying to do this religious group a favor, so they give them a charter. In the states that really conduct a rigorous process of that's what a charter is. I send in my 100-page, 200-page outline of what I'm going to do with my school. Here are my promises. And someone looks at it, judges my credibility, judges my track record, sees if I have a realistic budget and a realistic plan, and then they give me what's called a charter. But what the charter says is, hey, if you're not doing this when we inspect you in 2 months and 6 months and a year from now, 2 years from now, we're going to take away your charter. We're going to throw you out of business.
But the charter
they never do in the public schools.
But the charter usually also allows you to go forward without full compliance with union demands.
Oh, without any compliance, you can hire as you wish. But
you can hire non-union personnel.
Right, but there are charter schools that do have a union contract.
Yeah.
It's called a union contract light, typically. You know, the mm-hmm. unions like to say we have unionized charter schools.
Have the
that
two
work.
Big teachers' unions, NEA and AFT, have they been opposed from the beginning?
Have they been what?
Opposed to the charter school movement.
They would tell you that they actually started charter schools. And in the case of the AFT, they have a charter school in Brooklyn that is one of the schools that is failing because they have the same short school day and the same union rights. However, the AFT has negotiated slimmed down contracts, like a 20-page contract in the Bronx with a charter organization. The regular AFT contract in New York City is 189 pages, single-spaced. And so it's technically unionized, but it works.
We are coming up to another time for a news break. And when we return, I got a story to tell you about the political scientist at the University of Chicago whose three kids going to a supposedly great private school, namely the University of Chicago Lab School, mm-hmm. were still not doing very well. But he, the famous but unnamed political scientist, took an invitation to go to Paris, to the L'École des Hautes Études en Sciences Sociales, where he would be about a year and a half in Paris doing work and working on a book and teaching there and so on. And his kids were to go to ordinary Parisian lycée. And what happened when the kids went to the French school and why? I'm going to develop that further, if only briefly, when we return after we pause for an update on the news from Paula Cooper.
Extension 720 with Milt Rosenberg on 720 WGN.
And directly back to Stephen Brill as we continue to talk around the issues so fully developed in his new book, Class Warfare, Inside the Fight to Fix America's Schools. The story about the University of Chicago professor, my colleague. He and his wife and their three kids go off to Paris. This is a good 20 years ago. Mm-hmm. The kids all had some trouble in school. They didn't go to an inner city mm-hmm. public school in Chicago. They went to the lab school of the University of Chicago. But the youngest, a boy who was in the elementary school, was really somewhat reticent and somewhat resistant to what was happening. He wasn't really performing, and the parents were concerned about him. The girl, who was sort of at junior high school level, was adequate in performance, but was rather, again, the parents felt not very interested in, wasn't getting grades to the level that she ought to be able to attain, given what they assumed to be her special abilities. And the oldest child, the son who was in high school, really was almost in a depressive funk and really had what they took to be some serious problems. Indeed, they had already started him on a course of treatment with a local psychiatrist. Off they go to Paris. The kids are all put into a lycée. This is the standard kind of system in France, run by the government, by the federal, by the national government. They, as you know, sure. They have long school days, including half a day on Saturday, every Saturday. They drill them. They make them memorize. They test them on just about everything every week. And they had been there for about a year when we descended on a trip in Paris. I called my friend, and we went to dinner together with his wife. And lo and behold, the one thing that they couldn't stop talking about was how the kids had been transformed in this school system. They had a newly developed interest. They had all quickly picked up French. The two older kids knew a little bit of French. The youngest one didn't, but had, of course, as a young kid, become totally fluent in French. And they were enjoying their work, and their psychological problems had faded away. School had given them a new lease on life, a new energy, a new vitalization. Now, this tells you that even a good private school, because that's what the University of Chicago's lab school is, isn't necessarily performing at the highest possible level. What they were convinced of, the two parents, was that the sheer rigor and demand and the high expectations set by the school and the discipline imposed on the students was what these kids needed, and it transformed them.
Well, I think high expectations are a huge part of this formula. And it's especially relevant, especially important in communities where the expectations for the kids, not necessarily from the parents, but from the teachers who are supposed to teach them, are low. And where there's sort of a culture of failure. One of the interesting things in the book is the people who become school reformers, this network that I talk about, are invariably teachers who went into the Teach for America program, which is, you know, is sort of high-achieving college graduates who spend a couple of years in inner-city schools teaching. And they're pretty effective, although if they're only there for a couple of years, they're never
during
effective.
Their brief visits, so to speak.
If they're only there for a couple of years, they'll never be really great teachers, typically. But they're more effective than the rank and file first and second year teachers, but not by much. But the ones who succeed there, and they succeed because they're used to succeeding. They got into great colleges, and they start out in these schools, and they're failing for the first few months. They can't get to these kids. The kids won't listen to them. But they come up with gimmicks. They come up with something that will help them reach these kids because they just refuse to fail. And they refuse to expect that the kids will fail. Well, one of the issues they have is that they realize that, okay, so I'm in the middle of this school where failure is sort of the expectation, and now I'm succeeding. But if I'm in the third grade, if I'm teaching third grade, when I finish succeeding with these kids, they're just going to be tossed right back into the pit in the fourth grade in a system and with teachers who don't expect them to succeed. And that frustrates this group of teachers so much that they decide that they have to go for systemic reform. They want to fix the system. So one of those teachers, those Teach for America teachers, is Michelle Rhee, who succeeded in Baltimore as a teacher.
And then she went to D.C. to run the system.
Well, she went to the Kennedy School to get a degree and said, you know, I want to go into education policy. Another is a guy named Dave Levin, who succeeded as a Teach for America teacher in Houston and was so frustrated by the system that he said, I want to start my own school. And he started what became, with his colleague, his partner, the network of charter schools called KIPP, which are the most successful charter schools in the country. So they
that acronym stands for what?
Knowledge is Power Program, KIPP. And so they all sort of decided they had to do something at the macro level, because if they were just doing what they were doing at the micro level, it wasn't going to reclaim these kids' lives. They'd have sort of a temporary respite for the year they were teaching them, but then it wouldn't stick.
Do you know the experiment done by a professor at Harvard, another psychologist, Robert Rosenthal, done a good 20 years ago and reported in his book Pygmalion in the Classroom?
No.
May I tell you about this briefly?
Please.
It's quite relevant. Rosenthal was the the man who discovered and conceived something which we call experimenter expectancy, which means, and originally it has to do with the social psychology of psychological research itself. The basic finding, which he demonstrated again and again, was that if you give the experimenter expectations about how the human subject that he's running through some task is going to perform, those expectations will influence the actual performance of the subject. And that can lead to false confirmations and false disconfirmations of hypotheses in experimental situations. That's all by the side. That's where it started. But then he had the thought, what if you give teachers the expectation that some of their kids are about to bloom, that they're going to do wonderfully well in the new semester about to begin? Would that affect the actual performance of the student? In the San Francisco schools, he and Lenore Jacobson got permission to do a big real-life experiment. They set up some 20 classrooms in which the teachers would be 20 experimental classrooms and 20 control classrooms. And in the experimental classrooms, they were allowed to say to all the teachers, here are our, we've been investigating the students who are in this class, and we've got data to, which suggests that some of them are about to bloom. That tends to happen. That's something which happens as kids are going through school, they said to the teachers. They're lying a little bit. They're lying a good deal. They then single out four or five kids in a given class of 30, and they tell the teachers, these are the kids who are the potential bloomers. If you watch them, you'll see that they should be going forward faster than the other kids in terms of acquiring new skills and levels of learning and retention and general creativity and so on. So they just give this. Now, the children of whom they said this were, of course, selected at random. There was nothing about them which was at all special. But the teachers have the expectations that students A, B, C, and D are going to really do very well, whereas students E, F, G, etc. Will be more average. After a year of this, with the testing of the students as compared to control groups, control classrooms, who were not given all of this special experimenter, rather teacher expectancy manipulation, the kids of whom the expectancy was established did, to a significant degree, by statistical analysis, really did better in terms of the tested skills. Now, how does that work? One doesn't fully know. But it was Rosenthal's thesis. It wasn't a magical thing. It wasn't paranormal. But rather, it affected the way the teachers responded to these kids. They held them to higher expectancies. And they rewarded them more for little increments of learning or of mastery. And that made all the difference.
Well, that's really interesting, and it certainly adds a layer to my knowledge of this. But my observation is actually much simpler, and that is that the schools that really do well just refuse to believe that their teachers can't get through to these kids, and it's not based on some magic. Again, it's based on a longer school day. It's based on, at the charter school I was telling you about, the teachers come back from summer vacation the first week in August and train and retrain and prepare for 3 weeks before the kids come back the last week in August. In the union contract, the teachers come back for half a day right after Labor Day, and the kids come back the next day. So their training is half a day. That stuff counts. The really interesting and depressing thing about teaching in K to 12, especially in challenged schools, is that it's really hard, and the details count. The attention to detail, the intensity counts a lot. I've sort of come to believe that the reason so many people got into education policy who were teachers is it's sort of like the reason a lot of writers become editors. Doing policy is a lot easier than teaching.
I've got an email here from one of our listeners, even though I've not yet invited email or phones, that I want to read to you directly after we return from a quick round of commercials. But first, it is time to say to our listeners that we will be entertaining your questions and your comments, your reports. They don't merely have to be questions. Anything a teacher, a parent, a student wants to say in response to what you've heard so far tonight, get in there at 312-591-7200. 312-591-7200. The lines are open now, though we will be deferring until after the half hour. And at that point, we will go to the phones. 312-591-7200. For email, wherever you are in the world, if you're at some great distance and want to get through, email is the best modality. And you get to us at wgnradio.com. Email to extension 720 at wgnradio.com. Extension 720 as one word at wgnradio.com or 312-591-7200. But some special thought from the University of Chicago, which I have in an email in front of me, and I shall read it to you and to all who are listening right after this.
Extension 720 with Milt Rosenberg on 720 WGN.
And we return directly to Stephen Brill. And I said I had something I wanted to read to you. This is an email that comes from one of our listeners. And he says, in the popular book Freakonomics, Stephen Levitt and Stefan Dubner, and these are both guys at the University of Chicago, as you know, analyzed data from Chicago public school students who went to charter schools and traditional schools. The analysis showed that the students who were applied for admission to charter schools outperformed those who were not applied for admission, regardless of whether they were accepted by the charter schools' lotteries. This distinction had a bigger effect on student performance than actually attending charter schools. The conclusion is that having a parent who seeks the best for their child is the most important factor in a good education, and that charter schools are a distraction to the necessary goal of increasing parent involvement. Could your guest comment on these findings?
Yeah, that's total nonsense. I mean, if they wrote that in Freakonomics, I don't remember they
did. I think
did.
They did.
Well, they don't know what they're talking about. In fact, there was a specific study done a couple of years ago by the leading researcher and professor at the Harvard Education School who has studied all the issues related to teacher performance. And what he did was took a group of kids who applied to charter schools in the Boston area and compared their the performance of those who got into the charter schools and went on through the charter school system with the performance on the same test of kids who didn't get into the charter schools in the lottery, and found that the kids who didn't go to the charter schools obviously did much, much worse, not even a comparison with the kids who went to the charter schools. So there he was, quote, controlling, unquote, for parental involvement, because both sets of parents entered their kids in the lottery. They just compared the results of the kids who won versus the kids who didn't win. That's exactly the kind of, false data that, the deniers of education reform, talk about. That's not to say that, again, that all charter schools are effective, not by a long shot, but whoever sent that email, if they were with me, the moment I went from one side of that building to the other to watch the teacher screaming about the days of the week, when you see that, you can't have debates about education policy.
But you do acknowledge that if you looked at other charter schools, you wouldn't necessarily find so much of a difference between
neighboring one. This issue is not about charter schools. People get hung up about that. This is not about charter schools. This issue is if you take a school where the expectations are high, the teachers work intensely, train hard, prepare hard, work hard in the classroom, and they assume that their kids can succeed, not fail.
You could do that in the public schools.
You
could do that in the public schools. Are you suggesting
that? You do do it in the public schools.
Yeah, let me get this in. This is very important. Are you suggesting that this could happen much more often in the public schools but for the influence or the controls exerted by the teachers' union?
Yes, and in fact, what the book recounts is that is starting to change. The AFT, with the encouragement of the Gates Foundation and Gates Foundation grants, is working with the school system hand in glove in Hillsborough County, Florida, which is Tampa, in Pittsburgh, in Memphis, and doing exactly the kinds of reforms we're talking about, measuring teacher performance, encouraging the best teachers, retraining the ones who aren't succeeding, ushering out the ones who can't succeed, doing all the things we've just talked about with the union's cooperation in a public school setting, and that stuff is the same thing as what the effective charter school does. So you can't have a debate about something called charter schools versus public schools. That's not the issue.
This, in fact, brings us to the rather sacco surprise conclusion of the last chapter of your book. When we talk about teachers' unions, and by the way, there the story I told you about the kids who went to the Parisian Lycée.
Yeah.
They don't have teachers' unions in France that have the strength of our NEA or even our AFT.
None do.
None do, including Estonia and Latvia, apparently.
And including the reform deniers always cite Finland.
Yeah.
That's just nonsense. The union isn't as strong. There are work rules and union contracts in urban systems. Like, for example, in New York, there's a rule that says a principal can't comment on the form of a teacher's lesson plan. How's that for a recipe for accountability?
Indeed. They've controlled everything down to the hemi-demi-semi-quaver,
yeah,
is what
exactly.
You're saying. But as I talk about your last chapter, it turns out that the AFT, at least the American Federation of Teachers, is somehow remediable. And you had an experience with the woman who runs the whole thing around mm-hmm. the country, Randy Weingartner.
I spent a lot of time with her. Tell us about
the recommendation that you made to Mayor Bloomberg.
I think if you had a strong chief executive like Mike Bloomberg or Rahm Emanuel, you could do a lot worse than put someone like Randy Weingartner in charge of the schools as long as it was clear that you were the boss, because she is very smart. I think her heart is ultimately in the right place. She does not want to be, she told me, the next president of the United Auto Workers, meaning she doesn't want to bargain her union out of existence by having such straitjacket contracts that the competition, i.e., you know, charter schools, just takes over. And she knows that clause in that union contract about lesson plans. She knows the clause that was inserted that gave teachers an extra, you know, period off. She knows where all the bodies are buried. She knows, and she has the credibility and the respect of teachers. Ultimately, for example, in Colorado, which didn't get the Race to the Top money, just the way Illinois didn't, they enacted the toughest education reform law in the country, state law. And they now, the reformers will tell you that the unions, because the law's been passed, are sitting at the table with them and helping them implement it. I mean, this stuff isn't easy. For example, I keep saying teachers need to be measured for performance. It sounds great. But how do you measure a music teacher for performance? It's not a test. How do you measure social studies?
Maybe if the kids come out of the room humming.
Well, but the best way to do it is to take the best music teachers yeah. in the district and put the problem to them. And the union can help you do that. Mm-hmm. You know, again, I'll come back to it. Teachers know what good teaching is. Every fourth grade teacher knows who the worst and best third grade teacher is.
We're about to pause for an update on the news. Then to the phones, 312-591-7200. But once a month, I find myself inevitably quoting Vladimir Ilyich Lenin for the title of one of his pamphlets. What is to be done? What is your recommendation?
Well, I think, again, you have to bend the system, change the system. You have to change the union contract, and you have to substitute a culture of protection. You have to get rid of a culture of protection in the workplace for a culture of performance. And I'm not saying something terribly radical. I mean, we're sitting here in a radio station. I assume people here in some way get measured based on how well they do their jobs. There's nothing terribly
radical about that. Ratings by arbitrage.
Well, some people get who's ratings. Listening. You know, whoever picks the guests, yeah. someone whoever's in charge of the people who pick the guests, say, you know, you did a lousy job picking that uh-huh. guest last night. He was terrible. Or he was great.
Well, tonight's guest has been great, and we'll see how he does. In the last half hour, when we take phone calls and email, all the lines are taken at the moment. If you're trying to reach us, you're hitting the busy signal, but don't be totally discouraged. Simply try again after we say goodnight to a prior caller. The number will remain 312-591-7200. And, of course, for email, where we've got infinite capacity on the board, the email address, extension 720 at WGNradio.com. And now to the WGN Newsroom and Paula Cooper.
Milt Rosenberg and Extension 720 on 720 WGN.
The book in hand, which I would urge all who care at all about education to get their hands on and read, is by Stephen Brill, our guest tonight. It's titled Class Warfare, subtitle Inside the Fight to Fix America's Schools. Simon & Schuster, the publishers. And remember what Diogenes Laertius said, the foundation of every state is the education of its youth. And remember what Epictetus said, only the educated are free. And if we don't educate our kids well, the Republic will fall one way or another, I should think. 312-591-7200 is the number. We go directly to the phones. And the first caller is Dick. Good evening, sir.
Oh, good evening, gentlemen. How are you?
Yes, sir. Go ahead, please.
Okay, let me preface my remarks. I taught school for 35 years in Chicago and in Kenilworth. What you haven't mentioned for an hour and a half is discipline. I was the most idyllic person in my class in school. I was sent to some rough neighborhood, and I got books thrown at me, chairs thrown at me. I went to the principal. No one helped me out. I taught for 35 years. I had 20 great years with the most sweetest children in the world and parents. I had 15 of the most horrible years. They couldn't give me $1 million. No one's talking about the disrespect that they have for teachers. In other cultures like you
The one was a suburban job. The other was in the inner city. Is that it?
It doesn't matter. Couldn't care about race or this. If you're in a bad room in a good school, a disaster. It depends on the classroom. You can take the best teacher in the world, put them in a room, and I had 40 kids with BD, EBD, and LD children. No one backed me up. I don't care about the unions. It's like a jungle. It's impossible to teach. You get threatened. I was threatened. I said, this kid's threatening to kill me. The principal said, he doesn't mean it. Well, that's wonderful. Meanwhile, I'm trying to teach. How do you evaluate teachers? You give me a good room, and my test scores, which I hate to say, went up. You give me a rough room, they will go down. Now, what they told me is, you can handle the rough ones. Well, I didn't want to handle the rough ones. I want to have a nice bunch of kids that I could teach and respect me. Let me give you one example, and then I'll hang up.
Don't hang up, but be brief, because we want to get a response.
If you had your screener that was rude, and you had every guest that was yelling at you, and all your coworkers, you know, try to sabotage you, let me know how your performance would be.
Mm-hmm.
That's what it's like teaching in a rough neighborhood.
All right, let's get
a
response. Let's get a response from Steve Brill.
Well, you've mentioned one part of the equation that obviously needs to be mentioned, and that is the leadership of the school, the principal. The most effective schools have not only intensely good and dedicated teachers, but principals who feel the same way. Where I think I did you say all your classes were 40 kids?
I had 47 kids in a class. I started in 1970. I had 47 kids in a demountable unit on the south side. I taught at wonderful North Shore schools, which it didn't matter if they have exhibit bad behavior, swearing and hitting and fighting and hitting teachers and everybody else. You are in trouble.
Well, I will just tell you that I saw teachers who had, you know, 25, sometimes even 30 kids in a class who were predisposed to that kind of behavior, who stuck to it and were able to get control of those classrooms. I mean, I just have to tell you as a statement of fact.
I lasted 35 years. I would like to take Emmanuel Daly and anybody. Arnie Duncan came in my room and said, what a wonderful job. Dallas came in, what a wonderful job. I would like to have left and let them in their classroom and see how they did. You know, everyone can pontificate how great it is and the teachers aren't doing a good job. Put them in the classroom, and I think I'm speaking for a majority of teachers. It's great to hypothesize and sit there and write about it. Go in the classroom. Don't tell them who you are. In a rough classroom, I don't care where you are, Kenilworth, inner city, couldn't matter to me. See how you do. That's all I'm saying.
Sir, you've said it well, you've said it strongly, and I thank you for the call. And we'll go quickly and directly to the next one, and that next caller is Joe. You are on the air. Good evening.
Hi, I'm a classroom teacher for 27 years. I would like to ask both of you, how do you measure the effectiveness of a teacher?
Well, I'll answer that, because from the tone of your question, I think you're implying that you can't measure the effectiveness of a teacher fairly. The way it is measured in the most effective measuring systems, whether it's in public schools that are going through reforms such as the ones I mentioned in Tampa or Memphis or in charter schools, it's a combination of the students' progress in tests from the beginning of a year to the end of the year, peer observations, supervisor observations, expert observations, feedback even from the students, sometimes feedback from the parents. But the implication of that question is that because you can't guarantee fairness, you shouldn't try to do it. Every workplace in the country, no matter where it is, whether it's this radio station or a football field or any place, has an issue of how do you measure the performance of the people who are working there. It's
to what you just said?
Excuse me. It's never completely fair. There are always people who are judged unfairly. It's never perfect. But that doesn't mean that in the most responsible, important, and largest occupation in this country, you just throw up your hands and say, well, because it can't be perfectly fair, we're just not even going to do it at all.
And I never said that. I never implied that either, sir.
Make your further point, sir. Go ahead.
You said before the break, you said that performance-based assessment is not radical. And, Milt, you mentioned Arbitron ratings, as if you were going to equate Arbitron ratings on a radio talk show to some measure of teacher performance. Are you serious? You're comparing apples and oranges. A radio talk show host can appeal to the least common denominator of the population. And by the way, the audience is not measured by a test at the end of the show.
Well, that was obviously tongue-in-cheek. It was obviously just an example of a metric.
But it is a metric, exactly, of evaluation, yeah.
And it is a metric of evaluation, but, Milt, you are a former professor, professor emeritus.
Yes.
What do you think about these, for example, what do you think about these websites, RateMyProfessor.com? Is that a good measure of teacher performance?
Well, I've always been opposed to that, quite apart from their being on websites. I know they have shown up there. But also, many universities, including the University of Chicago, began to take very seriously ratings of teachers by students.
Yeah, I think they're great. I mean, I get rated for the class I teach, and what really bothers me about it is that the rating is kept secret from people in the outside world. The only people who can see the rating, at least at Yale, are the people who took the course or people who are students who want to take the course, and then it sort of goes down off the website a month later. I think it's absurd. Information is a good
thing. Well, it's a very bad system if it gets to the people that you're working for, if it gets to the chairman of the department or the deans, because then the young, non-tenured assistant professor will alter his course to try to win great popularity.
I think you sound like a UFT teacher. You're totally wrong, Milt.
I am, huh?
Yeah.
May, before you go on to another caller, I want to make a point.
Information is good.
Go ahead, sir. Yes.
Thank you. And the point is this. Teaching is, as you both know, teaching is an incredibly difficult profession. And the teacher is but one variable in a multivariable situation. When you can control for all the other variables, then use a test to measure the effectiveness.
Well, you know, that's not totally unlike what the first caller was saying. There he was saying he couldn't possibly have been a good teacher when the kids were so rambunctious, so aggressive,
But let's just reverse that.
Go ahead.
For a minute. If you have two teachers who are fourth grade teachers or fifth grade teachers, and over the course of 5 years, one of the teachers has the lowest performance rating based on the progress of their kids from the beginning of the year to the end of the year in tests. 5 years in a row, the absolute lowest among, let's say, 10 teachers teaching, the fifth grade, whatever it is. And another of the teachers has the highest among the 10 teachers 5 years in a row. Would you say that's just a coincidence? Would you say that's luck? And at the same time, the peer review analysis, the supervisor analysis also says that the teacher with the highest score ratings also appears to be the teacher who connects best with the kids in the class, and the one with the lowest rating appears to be the teacher who connects least best. Wouldn't you say there's maybe a difference in those two teachers?
Of course I would. You're absolutely right. Incidental point. You know about the graduate record exam.
Yeah.
Which people ordinarily take before when they finish the baccalaureate and they want to go on to graduate school. It's the equivalent of the
law boards and the...
Exactly.
Yeah.
Do you know the datum? It's established a long time ago. I think it is still the case that on average, depending upon the kinds of graduate schools that people go to, the ones who have the lowest GRE scores are those who apply to and or get into teachers' colleges.
That is an unfortunate reality today. Now, one thing we haven't talked about was in the 50s and 60s.
We don't attract the best people into teaching.
In the 50s and 60s, public education in this country was the beneficiary of a subsidy. The subsidy was employment discrimination against women. Mm-hmm. So if you were a woman who graduated from a good college,
you're right.
The only profession you were likely to be able to get into
teaching or nursing
was teaching.
Yeah, nursing also, but that was harder.
Right. Not being a lawyer, not being a banker, not being a doctor. Now, when that subsidy disappeared, when women, thank God, got equal opportunity, you started to experience the phenomenon you're describing.
It's a very good point. And a last round of commercials awaits, and then back to the phones. 312-591-7200.
Extension 720 with Milt Rosenberg on 720 WGN.
And we go quickly and directly back to the phones for your comments and questions to Stephen Brill, author of Class Warfare, Inside the Fight to Fix America's Schools. 312-591-7200, and Alex is next up. Good evening, sir.
Good evening, gentlemen. I'm from Russia, actually, and, well, to answer your question, what has to be done? Vladimir Ilyich answering the last page to this question. But unions and short school day is not a problem. In Russia, for example, we get 4 hours of elementary school, and by the time I was done with elementary school, we launched First Man in Space. It was highly structured and centralized system. For example, you open textbook, and all country with the same textbook, huge country, will be on the same page at the same very day. And what we have here, for example, I worked at West Side, say so, yes, and first what they did to the school, they split it into 4 small schools, and we have 4 principals, 4 assistant principals, 4 offices, and 1 major principal, and when experiment failed, they merged using $10 million again all together. See?
Hold on a minute, sir.
That is an experiment that a lot of the foundations, it was sort of for a while the reform flavor of the month, which is break big schools into small schools.
Yes.
And as you point out, it didn't work. I will say, with all, you know, with all great respect to your country, Russia is not today one of the countries.
Place, yes.
Is not today one of the countries that scores higher than our American students do.
Absolutely, because they get rid of this Prussian system of education now. They were on the top, now on 17 or even further. And but I still think it was a gross misuse of funds and no structure, and all these programs and innovation of Chicago Reading Initiative. 1 year, as Gorbachev, 1 program, 1 year. Next year, forget about these new lesson plans and new and new and new. And why education was still better here about 35 years ago? We didn't have all charters, all computers, all technology. It was just chalkboard and handouts, and they somehow learned. That's the question.
I'm not sure I understand the question. I mean, think education, as I said, education was better here, 30, 35 years ago, in large part because the schools had a talent pool of people. Half the population coming out of colleges, women who couldn't get good jobs in the other professions that they've now gone to. Interestingly, Randy Weingarten, the president of the teachers union, is a lawyer. Her sister is a doctor, and their mother was a high school teacher.
Let me add one other thing that was quite different 35 years ago. We had more intact families. These days, you've got virtually half of all kids are raised in, about 4 out of 10 of all American kids, if they're young, if they're, say, elementary school age, are living with single parents.
Yes, may I say also one thing? One gentleman was complaining that things were thrown into him. I worked at Westside for 10 exact years, and you know what? I was never threatened physically, never was accused of anything or biased or whatever, and on the contrary, I have very good control on my classroom. So it depends who is first, kind of.
I'm sure you were and are a very good teacher. I thank you, sir, for the call.
Thank you.
Very glad to have heard from you. We go quickly, time being so short, to another on 312-591-7200. And next up is Bonnie. Good evening. You're on the air.
Yes, good evening. I find the comparison between European schools and our schools are completely different. We had a friend that came from Romania, and he was brilliant. He was a straight-A student, and so was my daughter. And in foreign countries, they treat the smarter you are, the more important you are to the country as a future. Even financially, they will help you to get to achieve everything you want to achieve as far as schooling. Now, here, he came to our schools. My daughter was in a gifted class, 10 other children, all straight A's, all through school. They had a teacher that was certainly not creative, unless that's how they teach. It was the first time they had gifted students in the 80s. And what they did was, his object was to give the kid, present him with the schoolwork, and say, figure it out. You're gifted, figure it out. And that's how they taught him. She would come home and have homework till 11 o'clock at night. Now, my whole theory is the difference between a smart children and children that don't succeed are we going to say mentality is the same? I mean, should we be treating children? I mean, I don't know if you can. I think genetics has a lot to play in this. Can we take a child that comes from an environment where he'll never maybe be the astronaut or whatever, but should we have more trade schools or something to teach children? And I will say, out of these 10 gifted children, they all received eight-year scholarships in Northwestern, University of Illinois, all over, the best schools. And what happened was, out of that 10, nine of them dropped out within the first 6 months because of the burnout factor of this heavy schooling from fifth grade on, that then when they reached college, it was like a party atmosphere in what they had dedicated their whole life to eventually going to do, and they had skipped the first year of college because they had already exceeded.
Ma'am, we get the picture. Time is very short. Let's get some response.
Well, I'm not sure I heard a question in there, but again, I don't think we should just assume failure early on in any kid's life and track them off to trade school. I mean, we compete on a global stage now in a knowledge economy, and we have to have as many of our children be propelled forward as possible. And I don't like the idea of some teacher making a judgment in the fifth grade or the seventh grade or some test making a judgment that this kid can succeed and this kid can't succeed. I think we need to assume, at least through high school, that everyone can succeed and can come out of high school either career ready or college ready.
Our thanks to that caller. Let me read you an email I've got in front of me. Time is really very short, but I want to work this in. Two different friends who have taught at two different schools have complained that pressure from lazy but popular colleagues makes it very hard to uphold academic standards appropriate to subjects and grade levels. One of these teachers resigned in the end, simply fed up. The other, a high school physics teacher, was ultimately treated better because she won a national award, so that her administration decided it would be in their best interests to treat her better. But this was only after deliberate efforts to motivate her to resign on her own. She is a whistleblower. Do you find laxity supported by politics commonplace in the schools?
Well, absolutely. And in fact, if you're talking about a physics teacher, I'll just bring up another issue, which is part of the race to the top in the federal policy is that to encourage more science, technology, engineering, and math teachers, better known as STEM, that school systems should pay them more, should offer higher salaries because there's a lot of competition for them in the private sector. The unions, of course, have resisted this to the bitter end. So if you're talking about recognizing a terrific physics teacher, the old-time union mentality is you really don't recognize anybody. You treat everybody exactly the same, and the only thing that makes their career work is their union contract, not how they actually do or the subjects they actually teach or their value to the school or to society as a whole.
Where do you go from here with this? That is to say, you've written a strong and a very interesting, a compellingly interesting book because you write so well and because the people you're dealing with are so interesting. But are you going to stay with this for the rest of your career?
I'm a journalist. I mean, I came into this with no axe to grind. I obviously feel very strongly about the subject, but it's a feeling based on what I actually observed. And I have some other things I want to write about. I have a business to run. I have kids to teach myself, though I don't do it nearly as well as the people I write about in this book. But I'll certainly have an active interest in this. It's compelling. It's an emergency. It's a national security problem for us.
I think it really is, exactly. And I haven't even broached the issue of the quality of college education, but you know, as a—
It's a whole other subject I've been thinking about.
It's another subject, but it's—
Talk about lack of accountability.
Well, there is. It isn't just—
why do tuitions go up 5% and 10% a year?
And why has the quality of the curriculum gone down? Almost in inverse proportion to tuition going up. There's a great deal wrong at the higher education level as well as in the K to 12. But we are indeed out of time. Time only to repeat yet once again that our guest has been Stephen Brill. That's spelled B-R-I-L-L, and the book in hand is titled Class Warfare: Inside the Fight to Fix America's Schools. The publishers, Simon & Schuster. And with that, we'll close for the evening. With thanks to all for listening, and a most cordial good night.